Welcome to the Red Caps Podcast, a podcast where we dip our caps in the blood of our listeners and we ramble on about old school games. Today's episode comes with a mild language warning attached to it. If you listen to the show and you have kids around, just be aware there might be some mild cursing in this episode. And that's because we're sitting down for a conversation with the Angry GM of the Angry GM blog. If you're not familiar with the blog, it offers really cool and interesting perspective on GMing, and Scott's got a very unique style, which some can find loud and boisterous, but I personally find hilarious and very interesting. So we had a really great chat, and hopefully we'll get to do it again very soon. But since no mortal can outrun a red cap, I hope you can sit back, listen, and enjoy.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm joined by the Angry GM, who runs a pretty awesome blog called The Angry GM, and he gives GM advice and isn't too afraid to tell people exactly what he's thinking at any given time. Welcome to the podcast, sir. How are you doing today?
Good, good. Thanks for having me. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm being too friendly already.
I'm always kind of, anytime I've read your blog, and I've been reading it for a while now, anytime I've read it, I don't know how much of what I'm about to say will resonate with you, but I always kind of think of it as like the Strong Bad / Homestar Runner era mixed with the angry video game nerd.
Okay, very strong influences both, to be fair. Another one, and this is where the cartoony aspect comes in, because if you look at my art, it's very cartoony, and I, until 2 weeks ago, used Grawlix for all of my swearing, but the Grawlix have finally been phased out. So Yosemite Sam.
Ah. Yeah.
From the old Looney Tunes.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm sure that whole persona has generated a bunch of feedback. Where did the persona come from? Like what made you decide this is the niche I'm going for to kind of, you know, set the tone for everything?
Well, actually it wasn't so much a niche, or it wasn't so much a tone or a persona as much as it was legitimate bitterness. Okay. No, this is one of those stories that it was funny at the time, but now, you know, 12 years later or 14 years later, I kind of regret. But back in around 2007, I was not active in the online role-playing game community at all. I had my home games, but I did a lot of like convention stuff and local game store stuff. I started to get online when Wizards of the Coast did their big push for fourth edition. They announced it was coming out. Everybody was really excited. It was a really exciting time. You know, that it was one of those, I think it was the last time when everybody was super excited for a new edition. But anyway, I got involved. I started hanging out on the Wizards of the Coast forum and things like that. And this guy was looking for someone to co-host a podcast with him about 4E content. And I contacted him because I thought it sounded fun. And we developed a format for a show. We built, the format, had like 10 episodes, you know, pretty good following out of the gate for 2008. And things were going well. And then we got contacted by a gentleman named Dave Noonan, who was a designer and editor at Wizards of the Coast. I think he started around the end of second edition in TSR, and then, or at least he was doing like Dungeon Dragon magazine at that point. And then he worked on third edition, but he was one of my favorite designers. And he did a lot of the official D&D podcasts, around the transition point between third and fourth edition. And he was a hero of mine. I was really excited that he reached out to us because he wanted to do the show. And over a Thanksgiving weekend, my co-host decided that we had creative differences. He took the show, scrubbed me from it. And that was that. I never got to talk to Dave Noonan except for years later. And I was just ousted. And he took the format that I helped invent. And I say this with a little bit of schadenfreude, then proceeded to run the show into the ground. So, but meanwhile, I walked away totally bitter. And I'm like, well, fine, I could do my own podcast. And then I realized that's a lot of work and I don't know how to do it. And all I had to do with him was just talk, because he did all the technical stuff and he had the equipment and everything. I still don't know how to do a podcast. So
me either. So, I barely get by.
So I said, you know what? I'll do a blog. And that'll be my blog. And I'm mad. So I'll be, because there was also this thing, Twitter was really becoming big in D&D at that point. Like everybody who was in the community was on Twitter. And so there was a thing where there were all these people who had the something DM in their name. There was the newbie DM. There was the friendly DM. There's this DM, that DM. Everybody was the something DM. I'm like, well, I'm pissed off. So I have an idea. And I became the angry DM. And then I went and immediately bought a domain and web hosting and called it the angry DM and did nothing with it for about a year because I'd had my revenge. And I never had really intended to do anything. But the other side effect of it was I got on Twitter. And there I just started joking and ranting and giving terrible D&D advice, you know, like DM tip, carry a gavel to symbolize your authority as a judge. And also you could use it to hit your players when they piss you off, you know, like tips like that. But that resonated with people. And then I had an idea for how to build staged boss fights inspired by God of War 3. And I'm like looking at the D&D 4E engine because
which has that, yeah, they've got the staged fights basically in 4E, right? Like depending on what the health status is of the monster at different points.
Yeah, they sort of did, and there was actually because 4E had this idea where first of all 4E was kind of unique in, you know, post 2000 D&D in that it decided that the baseline combat would be designed around the same number of monsters as players. Okay, whereas third edition, fifth edition, the challenge ratings were all balanced like a party against one monster.
Right.
But 4E said, no, groups are better. And it's true. It leads to a more dynamic combat experience if you have a group of combatants running around. But then what 4E failed to do was figure out how to scale that down to solo fights. So 4E was a lot worse with the whole tank and spank mechanic than anything. You're not the tank and spank approach where you would just have the party swarm a baddie, it would get locked down, and then they would just beat the crap out of it. So I'm like, I have a better idea, and I basically took their like standard monsters that were meant to be four monsters to a party and said, what if I just stack all four monsters inside one skin? And then you can build things on the stage transitions and whatever. And I'm like, I wish I had something to do with this idea. Wait a minute, a year ago, I bought a blog. And so that was my first article. And it took off a bit. So, but I've been saddled with that, the angry DM ever since.
You say saddled. Has there been, I'm sure you get feedback all the time, but is it resonating mostly in a positive where people are like, oh, that's really cool? Like right before we started recording, I was like, you know, that I kind of dig the persona a little bit. Or do you get a lot of people that get just like they're offended or they're like, this is ridiculous. Stop doing that. Like, do you get both or is it one more than the other?
Obviously, I get a lot of people who actually think the persona is the draw. And after a while, I realized that there's a benefit to the persona, because if you've read any of my stuff, you know I write long form. Like I write long, okay? And I dig deep into every idea that I talk about, and I will go for 3, 4, 5,000 words, okay? The only way to get people to read 4 to 5,000 words of stuff is to keep it consistently interesting. And one way to do that is to have a unique voice. So that worked out to my advantage. The other thing that works out to my advantage is there are people who are immediately turned off by it, okay? And there is this phrase called getting the garden to weed itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm a fun-loving guy, okay? I remember when we could just have fun in a hobby, you know, and when we could joke around and just, you know, that kind of a thing. And I don't want to lose that. The sort of person who goes onto my blog and says, this guy can't even swear properly, and he thinks players are idiots. I can't listen to him. Is the sort of person I don't want listening to me anyway. They're not someone I would invite to my table.
Right.
So, you know, they keep themselves out now.
Yeah, I like that phrase, the garden that weeds itself, because if, you know, the people who are getting what you're doing understand that it's a persona, understand that that's not necessarily that it's meant to be a lightning tone. And those who get offended, well, there was no saving that person for you anyhow. So if they get offended and leave, so be it. You do mention that you write a lot. That's one of the things I really like, is that even if I don't agree with your advice on everything, I can read what you wrote and go, okay, he really thought about this. Like, I can see your reasoning and how you came to the conclusion that you did. And there's a lot of background of, you know, I'm proposing this because of these reasons, and you lay it out really well. You could almost call it like it's almost textbookish, the way that you kind of hand walk somebody through stuff. What's the writing process of that like? So like, when you sit down with a topic in your head, you're like, I gotta do this. What's the process and what's the schedule and everything of that like?
Well, like, the process has evolved a bit, and I've just gone through a big shakeup on my process again. So now what it is, I'll have an idea for whatever I want to write. And I never, until January of this year, until right now when we're talking, I never really bothered to try and plan my content in advance. And that caused some serious problems. And now that I'm doing that more, where I know what I'm going to be writing for the next couple of months here or there. But my first step is I will sit down and basically free write a summary or a description of the article I'm going to write. So it's going to be like, I'm going to introduce narration techniques, and I'm going to talk about, first I will explain why narration is important, and then I will explain why it is important to speak directly to people, especially if you're online, and I'll just like sort of just describe the article. I will then print that out and then handwrite an outline from that and say, okay, these are the headings, these are the major topics, make sure it's all organized so that it'll, you know, so that it flows logically from setup to conclusion. And then from there, I will take the outline and then I will draft the article from that. And I'll just, you know, basically just bang out the words. After I've done that, I will close it, walk away for you at least 15 minutes, but preferably a day. And then I will come back and rewrite every section. You know, like, I'll read the heading in the section, and then I will rewrite that whole section. And that's when I'll usually punch it up and make it angry. I mean, it starts there. But like, I've also over the years developed a sense of, There's an ebb and flow to it. Okay, like, if you read my articles, you'll notice that the angry persona comes and goes. And the more deeper I'm going into a serious topic, the more the angry persona fades in favor of making things clear. And then once I've hit a point where, okay, I've gone too long without being angry, I will suddenly jump in with a bizarre metaphor or swear or something, or just do an aside where I just abuse my players or abuse the industry or make fun of Jeremy Crawford or whatever. So I've developed a sense for that because it helps, you know, I know how much time a reader has before I'm going to lose them.
It's timing, kind of like how a comedian has to pace out a set and go with the ebbs and flows of it in terms of picking your points. And
or the way a GM has to be aware of the ebb and flow of tension at their own table. Yeah. So
yeah,
there's a lot of crossover in all of this stuff. But
I was going to say, I noticed when I was looking through on the blog there recently, you had a post for what your plan was for this year. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I saw on there was production codes. You were mentioning how this was your first time planning out stuff ahead, and you actually had production codes on there. And I was wondering, like, is that like a day job influence on how you decided to do this? Or did you go and pull inspiration from somewhere else of how you're kind of, you know, the script is in this stage at this point, and it's going to be at this stage and next point or what have you?
Well, first of all, I should point out at this point, this is my day job.
Okay.
So, formerly I was an accountant. So, but I was not a very good accountant. So, like,
that's why this is not a day job.
I had to leave for reasons.
Decimal points are really important, guys. You got to know where to put those.
But no, so this is the day job now, but I used to be an accountant. But as far as the production codes, it's just because I got sick of not being able to find my files. Because I would just, I do pile organization, right? I throw every article I've ever written into a folder.
Right.
And I couldn't go back and find them. And also it killed me that they're not in order. So literally the production code is just there so that, you know, when I open the window in Explorer, the things are in the order.
Yeah. So for me with the podcast, I've got one big folder in OneNote where I've got every time I get a stupid idea, I just create a new note in OneNote. I call all the ideas episode X, and then a brief of that. And then I think of stuff I throw it in. And then once I do the episode, it's episode number, whatever, like the thing gets renamed. So I've kind of got the pile too, where everything I've ever done is all in one spot, but I can find them only because the files are named in numerical order of how they go through history. So that helps me a little bit, but I can completely, I guess my episode numbers would be very similar to your production codes in that standpoint and just an organization standpoint.
I mean, not to ruin the great mystery here, but the production codes are actually very, very simple. They're just, I write 4 features a month. So the production code is like F and then 0103 for the third article of January.
Right.
You know, there's not any great mystery to it. And the other, I had to start doing that, especially because I started doing the recordings, which are bonus content for my supporters. So getting back to my process, after I have written absolutely everything and gotten a final copy that I'm happy with, I then, and this is something I've been doing for years, I read the entire thing out loud. And as I'm reading it out loud, I'm, you know, changing things like, oh, I swore too many times in this paragraph, which was a serious concern that I would have. I would be like, I have used this same swear too many times in this paragraph. But, you know, because a lot of people have said they appreciate the conversational tone. And when people said that, I'm like, well, how can I make sure that I nail that every time? And it's read it out loud and make sure it sounds like I'm speaking. But then, when I mentioned that to some of my supporters, because I'm Patreon supported. I mentioned to some of my supporters that I did that, and they'd be like, "Yeah, we'd love to hear that."
So what are you talking about? You're already doing a podcast. That is your podcast right there. It's just on Patreon.
Well, I am, but the nice thing is, it's like it's a one take. I'm literally doing a proofread of an article while I'm. While I'm reading the article out loud.
Okay. All the listeners, turn down your volume real low so you don't hear me say this. Part of the reason I really love doing all these interviews is that I have very little editing to do on them, and it makes it so easy that I just do my bumpers at the beginning, at the end. I stick the interview in the middle. Okay, everybody can turn your volume back up now. I completely see what you're saying. Like, yeah, sometimes podcasts can be a lot of work, and if you no, <it's good. laughs> But no, it is basically the same thing though. If you're going through the process of sitting down and recording that and sticking it up, you've got a podcast. The degrees of you know, post and editing afterwards is all you know, it all depends on what you're doing. But so you've already got this down. What do you use for your recording and stuff? Like what does your tool set look like?
So I have a computer.
Really? I do mine on an Etch-a-Sketch. Whenever I don't like the podcast, I just shake the crap out of it, and it all goes away. But so you got a computer. That's a good step.
And there's a microphone that plugs into it. And oh, I have Audacity. I use Audacity.
Yeah, Audacity is a great tool.
What's actually, I have a very generous supporter named Rattercrash, who is an audio editor, and he is also a musician. And he enjoyed the proofread alouds, as I call them, greatly. And then he offered to take the raw wave files, and then he does magic at them. And also he composed an intro and an outro, just intro and outro jingle. So he actually puts them together for me.
Ah, see, so you even get, yeah, you get there. Help on that side of it, and you're all set.
Yeah, so I literally just turn on the, plug my microphone in, start Audacity recording, and then just read the article out loud and argue with myself about it. Well, my fiance, she made fun of me when I would do the read alouds before I was recording them, because I talk to myself, I crack jokes, I crack myself up. I think I'm hilarious. So it's not unusual for me to stop and just have a conversation with myself in the middle of this. Oh, sure, Grammarly doesn't realize this completely made up word is misspelled, but yeah, because I sit here and worry about the spelling of my misspelled word. And so when I started doing the proofread alouds, I was catching that stuff and people thought it was a bit. And I'm like, no, it's not a bit. I'm just nuts. But in a funny way, a harmless kind of nuts.
So through the whole process of either doing the blog itself or getting the Patreon bonus stuff out, what's the most anxiety, or what part of it is the most difficult, do you find? Because you've been doing this for a long while. Like, the blog's been around for years. Like, what was harder before and easier now, or what's harder now going through all that?
All right. Well, I didn't realize this was going to be the sort of session where I got to pay you $200 an hour to talk about this.
Yeah, the tab comes later. I should have mentioned that in the invite.
All right. You know what? I'm just going to be honest here. I am still terrified that I am not good at this.
Okay. Yeah, imposter syndrome. Yeah. I think everybody deals with that in some way or another. I would say that your longevity at this point, for anybody who would look at you and say, clearly you are, because it's been successful. But I know personally that doesn't ever quell the personal feel of it at any point in time. But
well, beyond that is I don't have the desire to be a blogger forever, and crowdfunding is not a long-term business strategy. And I have allowed it to be a bit more of a long-term business strategy than I should have already. But I do have other projects in the offing. I mean, a couple of years ago now, I published a book, self-published a book. And that was supposed to be the first step, because then I wrote a tie-in module for that book that was supposed to be a short little introduction that GMs could use to introduce new players to D&D and other role-playing games. And it instead ballooned into a year and a half long, 130-page beast of a tutorial product. But like all GMs, especially now, for some reason, I have my own system in the offing. Because everybody's right. Every GM is writing their own role-playing game.
Yeah, well, I think that's always been the case. I think anybody, I would say that if there was only ever 100 games of D&D that were ever played, 98 of them did not play it rules as exactly as it was intended to be. Probably 100 of them, but let's be generous and say 98 of them were, and 98 of them had house rules and changes on them as well. So I think that's the only way to play, to be honest. But
oh, sure.
But yeah, I see that as well, that there's so many game systems coming out for being published and what have you. Sorry, I interrupt. I spun off there on you.
No, that's okay. But I just because you asked me what's difficult, moving beyond anything that is blogging terrifies me. Okay. And like I have, like even writing that module, it was delayed far longer than it should have been, because I was afraid that I was going to prove to everyone that I might give great funny advice, but I don't know how to design anything, And so that's really with every, I have plans, and I have two Kickstarters that I would like to launch in the next 12 months. And the biggest thing that I have to keep overcoming is just the fear of doing the next thing. because at any given point, I'm going to prove that I'm an imposter and a failure, and everybody is going to leave me, and I will have to go back to the debit mines and be an accountant again.
It's that same fear, I think, happens with a lot of people with just getting into DMing, period. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there's a lot of people that sit down, they've read the books, they've read your blog, they've gone and watched YouTube tutorials, and you're like, okay, I'm gonna go set up a game with my friends. And then when it gets close to the time to actually pull the trigger and do that, they go, oh no, everybody's gonna realize that I'm not very good at this. And mm-hmm. and that anxiety creeps in on folks. There was an article, I don't remember who published it, a bunch of people referenced it over the last like 6 months or something, about how D&D, especially fifth edition, had a DM shortage. Like that mm-hmm. there was people that you know, there was way more players. I mean, there's always been way more players than DMs, but you know, way more than normal.
That there was more than the crop of GMs that exist can support the player base at this point. Is
exactly, yeah. And a lot of the reasons behind it was people being, shying away due to either anxieties or thinking that expectations were too high or the social pressures that were involved in it. Do you think that's due to misconceptions from players about how GMing should be? Or is that a symptom of other things about how the game has been presented to people?
I'm going to take a different tack here. And I mean, this can go into the weeds now, because obviously with Wizards of the Coast, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, well, I'll come back to a more recent shitstorm later on.
I think that's kind of related, though. Because I question the conclusion. Okay, so here is the problem that we see. There is a shortage of GMs. There are far more players who want to play D&D than GMs who want to run the game.
Right.
Okay. So the conclusion is, the way GMing is being presented, or the way GMing is so scary, no one wants to do it. But hasn't that always been the case? Isn't GMing has not gotten any more terrifying?
I think so. Here's my view on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to, I'm not sure how well this will be worded without coming off as if I'm like knocking on an industry that I'm not actually, I don't really have anything against. But I think there was part of the 5e popularity was the abundance of online streaming of games. And traditionally, at least whenever I was growing up, people learned the game, either they went and they got a book and they sat with the book and they learned it that way, or they had a neighbor or an older brother or a friend or somebody went, I got this cool book, you got to come play it. And that's how they got exposed to the game.
Okay.
There's a lot of people that are getting exposed to the game without having that personal connection to it. Like not having that person sitting down showing them. So they're watching a tutorial on it, essentially, or watching one person's view of how the game gets played via a stream. And so then there's never that moment of like, oh, I want to run that. It's just like, I want to play that. So they don't, like, I think a lot of the original groups, you had one person that was looking for players and they went and they found people and said, hey, come play this with me. Mm-hmm. Whereas now you've got a lot of people that see it and now they're like, I need somebody to run that for me. But none of them seem to have the want to be the ones that set it up.
Now, see, and that's a very interesting point. Okay. But that what I think is, okay, there's two different ideas that I think we're talking past here, or talking that are kind of like passing each other.
Yeah.
So because you're not talking about the scariness of GMing here either.
I know. I think that becomes more of an excuse.
Right.
Yes, DMing is scary to a point, but I think because they haven't sat down with some, they weren't exposed to it from somebody that they know. Like it's different. If you see a personality mm-hmm. online do it, it would be the same as watching, you know, Bruce Lee do Kung Fu on a movie.
Well,
you have an unreal expectation. You're like, I can't do that. But if your buddy down the street runs a game, you might be like, oh, well, if Jimmy can do it, I can probably do it too. And it reduces some of that off of you.
Okay, hold on a second. Have you ever watched a professional sports thing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, have you ever played an amateur backyard sport?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, have you ever watched, like, Wayne Favre or Brett Gretzky or whoever, because I don't sports ball, but have you ever watched one of those people and thought, I'm going to go get myself a sports ball and I'm going to go out in the backyard, my friends, and I'm going to be Brett Gretzky?
As an adult, no. As a child, sure. But as an older adult, I can quickly go, I can't do that. Like, I can't perform at their level.
Okay. So I think when you were a kid and you had that, like, I'm going to go out there and be Brett Gretzky. You were not Brett Gretzky.
No, of course not.
Did you care?
No.
You just kept doing it anyway. Okay. I don't think there's really much to say about the whole idea of people. I'm watching Critical Role, an obviously professionally produced television show with actual actors. I could be Mike Mercer. I don't think anybody seriously thinks that.
No, I don't think anybody mistakes their ability to do, you know, the voice acting and everything else. But I think it's a couple of things. It's somebody looks and goes, oh wow, look at the table setup they've got. Mm-hmm. And I think the whole way that it's presented, instead of it being the hey, Stranger Things is also a professionally shot television show. When you watch those kids play, you're like, oh, they're just sitting around a basement table and they've got some pieces of paper and a few dice. And then you switch it over the other way. And I think obviously the streaming side of it with its high production values is done much more than, mm-hmm. than what people saw of the other. So I'm not saying I'm not trying to slam on that industry, but I'm just wondering if that leads to people having an unreal expectation of what they need to do. Not that they have to live up to it, but that that's where the bar was set for them.
See, and this is what I'm saying is, you know, I've looked at every other, you know, any other hobby or anything like that. It doesn't really stop people from getting involved to see professionals doing it. At the same time, nowadays, we have something that you and I, you know, I'm not going to make any guesses about anybody's age, but you and I did not have this when we were bouncing baby angries. We never had video tutorials. We had to learn this crap from books. Mm-hmm. It has never been easier for a GM to at least see, oh, the game is actually just a conversation. The GM's just making shit up, and the players are just making things up, and occasionally somebody rolls dice and the rule books tell you what to do. It's actually much less arcane than it's ever been.
True. Mm-hmm. I think if you can, if you go seeking that content, mm-hmm. I think if you seek out the people that will tell it to you that way, instead of those who are wanting to try to put on the best show themselves. So I think it really depends on what you're consuming, right? So if you go in and you look for somebody who's going to tell you that, you can find that. You can find everything on YouTube. But
Hold on. In his defense, Mercer tells
you. Oh, exactly, and I'm not knocking even on him. I think I have no issue with that show. I don't watch it a whole lot, but I have no issue with their show or anything. I'm just talking in general. I think there's a lot of folks that because that's the only version of it they see. And I completely get Mercer says, hey, we're all actors. This is our show. This is not how a normal. I'm not saying anything bad about him at all. I think he's fine. It's
not only that, he does on the side GMing advice, mm-hmm. where he tells you what to actually expect. And he literally tells people, you're not going to be me. Don't try to be me. Here's how to get your own table together.
Right. Okay?
So that's there on the same channel. And I don't think you're slagging on anybody. All I'm saying is it has become a common narrative that the reason why we don't have GMs is because online streaming shows set such unrealistic expectations that GMs see that and say, well, I could never do that. And then they are turned off from trying.
Okay. So then what would be, if we reject that narrative, if we say that doesn't make sense, what is the replacement narrative that we would put in place for it?
Okay. So first, I have two theories, okay, for why there is now a shortage of GMs, specifically with D&D. Okay,
I think we should be specific. I think this honestly only applies to 5th edition D&D, because I think I primarily operate in the OSR circles, mm-hmm. and most of the players are also DMs. And right. so like it doesn't become an issue really in those circles. But
well, Paizo has also not come out and said we have a shortage of GMs. And they're the next biggest thing, even though they're not nearly as big as they were.
Right.
In terms of market share. But okay. So here's the first thing to look at is the fact is this specifically a D&D problem? And okay, if it's specifically a D&D problem, is it about D&D 5th edition?
See, I don't know if so. I played D&D 5th for a little while, and then bounced off of it because it just wasn't the game for me. But I never felt anything overly difficult about running it. In fact, I'll still, if somebody came to me and said, "Hey, I want to play a 5th game," I would play in it. I don't want to run. Actually, I'm about to say exactly what you're saying.
Well, isn't
I don't
want that to run interesting?
The reason the reason I don't want to run it is the same reason that I don't prefer that game overall, is that to me, 5th edition feels like a superhero game, and I don't want to design superhero encounters and stuff like that. Like I feel that that's the vibe that the game goes for, and it's just not what resonates with me. Okay. I can play my non-superhero character in a superhero world, but so I don't mind being a player, but as a GM, I don't want to operate that world. So that's my preference of why I choose or don't choose that game. But I didn't find anything mechanically difficult about running it. Like there was nothing where I went, this game is harder to run than OD&D or harder to run than any other game I've ever picked up. It feels, very, the rules aren't all that much more difficult. It was just for me, the tone of the game isn't the sort of thing that I want to craft worlds around, which is why I don't like to run it.
Okay, but why assume you're any different from any other GM?
Because I'm assuming when I look at the playbase, there's a lot of playbase that really seems to enjoy that style of game. So I would assume that the playbase would have, in whatever population, there would be a similar number of people that want to create the world that they would want to play in. So like I primarily prefer to play in maybe a more darker, gritty world. So that would be the type of world I would want to create as well. And I would assume that if you're a person who likes playing in a more superhero, high fantasy type world that D&D creates, that you would then want to also run that sort of world. So I don't know that there's anything that inherently would turn the people who enjoy playing that style off from running that same style.
Except that you yourself also just said you can play that happily and enjoy it, but you don't want to run it.
Whenever I play it, though, I play the characters I play in those worlds are really not that different than the players than the characters I would play in the other one. I just choose not to embrace that side of it. But I see all kinds of people who do completely embrace that side. So I assume my assumption is that if you're willing to play that, then you would be willing to craft those worlds as well.
But isn't it equally possible that there is something about D&D 5, and I'm not even going to suggest what it might be, but is it equally possible there is something about D&D 5e that makes it more fun to play than to run?
I don't know. Like when I look at other games, like let's go way off the ball. If we went and looked at Starfinder or Traveler or Call of Cthulhu or any of these other games, I don't think they've got that same difference, and their rule sets are all different. There's a different tone now, and unless there's something that somebody can go, oh, here's a critical flaw for GMing, there's a critical mechanic that's wrong, I don't know if it's really a mechanic thing. Does it
have to be a mechanic thing?
I think it would have to be. Otherwise, how would you explain the massive difference between one game having this disparity compared to another one on the grand scheme? Like if it was a singularity one-off, it should be a very obvious thing then, I would say.
Well, okay. See, now, first of all, I'm not going to go ahead and like quote MDA theory at you here. Okay. But game mechanics do not make a game experience.
True.
Okay. It's the experience of playing a game comes from the interaction between the participants and the mechanics. Okay. Agreed. Which means presentational issues, expectation issues, tonal issues, those all factor into the equation of what makes a game feel good. You can have a game that mechanically seems perfectly well written, and still, just when you sit down and play it, it doesn't click. It doesn't come to, like, for a lot of people, that was fourth edition.
Yeah, I was going to actually say that exact same thing.
It was mechanically very innovative. It had a lot of really brilliant mechanics, and I will sing its praises in terms of design until the day I die. And the whole game just didn't work. It was the most well-designed game no one wanted to play ever. Okay. But so I'm not suggesting what it is, or even saying that this is necessarily the problem, but I'm just saying that if we have this situation where we're looking at one game that uniquely seems to be suffering from a shortage of GMs, and then we have GMs who are sitting around saying, you know, I'll play it, but I don't want to run it. And I don't even know why. I just, you know, it just doesn't feel right. Something's probably there that's worth examining.
Okay. Without asking you to pinpoint, but then I was going to ask you to pinpoint, is there something in there that you personally see that you're like, I think this might be not necessarily definitively what is causing it in that particular game? And again, my experience with the game is limited, so I don't have a whole lot to rebut you on, but is there something that you see in there where you're like, from the people I've talked to or the games that you've run, that you think harms the DM experience?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think it's a game that hates DMs. Or actually, I think it's a game that hates homebrewing.
Interesting. And considering it's one of the most homebrewed editions ever made.
Well, I mean, that's because it's an easy...
Because it's the most popular. But
right, yeah. Exactly. It's an easy way to homebrew, but it absolutely hates being tinkered with. I mean, okay, I'll give you one example. This is a small one, and I wrote about this in December. Okay, let's take the advantage mechanic.
Okay.
Okay. Perfectly fine mechanic. You roll a d20, and if you have advantage, you roll 2d20, you take the higher. Right? Very simple way to hand out bonuses. Okay. By itself, it seems good, but advantage is now an overwhelmingly good mechanic. It is better than just about any numerical bonus that you can grant. Moreover, even if it's not, but like, even mathematically, if I put like a +6 bonus is always better than advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I think somebody mentioned, I'd have to look at the math. I think it's like a plus, I think advantage works out to +4 or +5 essentially, right?
Yeah, it averages out to around +4.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, but because of the way it feels, when the player's rolling two dice and they get to take the higher roll, that feels really good. And when something happens, like they roll a 1 and then a 17, they're like, oh, thank goodness for advantage. It saved me from that 1. Right? So there's all these emotions wrapped up in advantage. There's also a lot of ways in the game to gain advantage from the character sheet or from the rules itself. You know, you can get advantage if you use this ability or that spell or whatever. Okay. Right. What that means is now as a GM, if I want to reward a player's clever plan for doing something in the game, normally in the past, I would give them a bonus. I would say, that's a great idea. Take +2 on your roll, right? Oh, you thought to outflank the enemy. Take +2. But now I can't do that because the player can already get the best possible modifier most of the time right off the rules. And anything I give is small potatoes. So suddenly the single most important language I have as a GM for communicating, thank you for interacting with the world and paying attention to the vulnerabilities and the weaknesses and leveraging your knowledge against this NPC you're trying to persuade, have a bonus. Instead, they'll say, I don't need your bonus. I have advantage whenever I make charisma checks. And also I'm a halfling. So if I roll a 1, I'll re-roll it. It's okay, great. I now have no language as a GM to even do something as simple and say, attaboy, good plan.
Yeah.
Okay.
They tried to fix that with the, what do they call it? It's their hero point or whatever. What's that system called?
Is inspiration?
That's what I was looking for. Inspiration. Yeah. I think they tried to implement it with that, but even that didn't seem to.
Well, this inspiration was another, like, that's another example of, okay, here's a free take advantage on anything role.
Right.
That's what it was. If you play what you wrote down on your character sheet one time, you get a free advantage on any roll you want. Well, now the next time you're in combat and you come up with the clever plan, I'm gonna outflank the foe, you know, and I would say have a bonus. You'd be like, I don't need your bonus. I have inspiration, advantage, and there's nothing better you can give me. An advantage doesn't stack.
Okay? Yeah.
Now, that is not the be-all. I'm not blaming advantage for all the reasons why D&D 5e just feels a little icky to run, okay? But it is one of the reasons right there, okay? It's a tiny little mechanic. It's so innocuous, and it seems like a clever idea. But then when you look about what it takes away from you, the game master, it's like, oh, suddenly I really don't have a way to make my players engage with anything other than what's written on the character sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's just, like I said, one example. That is not the be-all and end-all of the argument. It's just how these tiny little things and how they feel can just leave you feeling, you know what? I don't even know what I'm doing wrong. My players, they have no interest in what is going on in the world around them. You know, I set them up with chandeliers to swing off of and barrels to push over, and they don't do any of it because they're busy saying, well, when I make an attack and I'm using a light weapon and I have an ally within 5 feet, I have an advantage and do 6 extra dice of damage. Well, okay, then, you know, I guess we didn't need the chandelier.
No, and that kind of resonates with some stuff I've said too. Like I've made comments before that I find 5e players spend more time staring at their character sheet trying to find, and whether that's a character saying, well, I want to roll this skill that I have, rather than describing what they're doing and me saying, okay, now you can go and roll that particular skill if we have a skill-based game, or if it's a matter of the individuality that kind of comes with 5e characters due to, you know, the complexity behind them. So I can see where you're coming from with that. Those little things will add up to annoy or bother a GM. I guess my reason for not picking that out at the beginning was, again, the whole idea of, if you enjoy that as a player, then would you not also enjoy running that as a DM? And since I don't enjoy it really as either, it's, I guess I lack a little bit of the insight on that a little bit, but
no, it's just, like I said, it's just all these little things. But you say skill-based system. D&D is an attribute-based system.
It's supposed to be, but it's fifth edition is not.
There you go. Okay. Another weird little design choice. It wasn't meant to be a skill-based system. And the D20 mechanic is not a skill mechanic. It is an attribute-based mechanic. But they pared down the skill list so small, okay, that now, like when you go back to, say, 3.5, when there were so many skills on the character sheet, nobody could be guaranteed to have, no party could be guaranteed to be bringing every skill to the table. Then having a skill was a bonus. It's like, oh, okay, well, I don't have the skill for this, but we got to climb up this cliff anyway. So we'll either have to come up with a clever plan or just, you know, trust our fates to strength checks. Okay.
Right.
But now every party is guaranteed to have every skill. There's too few skills. And every, you know, and you know, the players do sit down and say, well, okay, I'll be the survival guy. Okay, I'll be the face. I'll be the this. So they all, you know, they claim the same wheelhouses, but there's so few wheelhouses. Now every skill is just on the character sheet and every party has them all. So now it's a skill-based game, even though it was never meant to be, which means the solution to every problem is pick the right skill and roll it. And there is never a situation, unless the GM is an expert at designing situations, there's never a situation where a problem can arise in the game that can't be solved with one die roll. And the most interesting problem solving happens when the players don't have the tool for the job.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole entire reason why encumbrance and proper inventory management and what have you makes the game interesting, is because you have to make decisions about what you've got and then how you use what you've got. And
well, now a first level Outlander Ranger can feed an entire party of five basically without a die roll. Well, congrats. Now, where is the meaning in wilderness? Like, now if you get lost in the wilderness, like, remember, when you used to get lost in the wilderness, it wasn't just the fact that you were lost, okay? It was that every day that you were lost, you were running out of food, you were running out of water, and there was a random chance that a green dragon would spring out from the trees and devour you. Well, you can't run out of food. We don't even talk about water. And nobody really does random encounters anymore. And also navigation checks are really easy. So what's left in wilderness travel now? It's just, well, you made it there. Huzzah. Okay. So all these stripped down mechanics that make it really easy to play and run the game have also robbed the GM's ability to build meaningful challenge and meaningful choices, unless the GM is an expert at doing that. Like, I can sit down and write a meaningful quicksand challenge that cannot be overcome simply by a player saying, well, I have the survive quicksand roll, and then rolling it, okay? I can do that, but it's hard. And I can't do that for 6 or 7 encounters a night every week. So just building meaningful challenges and encounters has become really, really difficult because the game has stripped away so many of the levers and buttons that you used to be able to push to build those. And, you know, you can go back to any edition and see the levers and the buttons that a GM could push. And so, a lot of them are gone now.
So that actually is a... someplace I was going to go with that conversation. You mentioned one of the first things that you emailed back to me whenever I approached you about coming onto the show is you said, hey, I'm not really into the OSR scene. You're like, that's not the style of play I play. You said you were familiar with it, but that's not the additions that you were with. I was wondering, it may not fit the angry persona, but if we were to go back and hit each of the major additions, what's the shining star, or what's the thing that you could hang your hat on for each one of those editions? And I ask only because I assume that you've looked at most of these, if for nothing else, just from a design perspective.
I really can't say that I have, to be honest. So first of all, my experience started with the Benser Red Box in 1998. And then I moved to Advanced Dungeons & Dragons because I wasn't a whittle bitty baby and didn't have to play basic D&D. And it was many, many years later that I discovered what a unique and different game, specifically the Menser series of box sets, was than any other edition of D&D, which I now appreciate a lot more. But so I played AD&D second edition until 12 years, I guess it would be 10 to 12 years. Third edition came out. I played that for its entire run. Fourth edition came out. I played that for 2 years and then started playing Pathfinder. Fifth edition, I played that. In the meanwhile, just so that nobody thinks that the only thing I've ever played in D&D, I also have played a crap ton of other games over the years. You know, I'm always curious about them. But I couldn't say now, like, what I seriously remember about AD&D second edition other than, after you have a universal action resolution mechanic, then it just looks like a mess. You know what I mean? The big thing I remember about AD&D was trying to, okay, now we're looking for a secret door. That's a D6 roll. Or, oh, okay, saving throw. What, you know, is this, like, okay, falling it down a pit, is that going to be a death save or is that a paralysis? You know, and like trying to remember all the weird little fiddly mindset because every rule was a little bit different. Nothing worked the same as anything else. So I have a really hard time even going back to pre-2000 with the advent of, you know what? This is what we're going to give you. You, the GM, here is one tool you can use to adjudicate literally any action anyone can come up with. There's 6 ability scores, fit it into one of those, assign a difficulty, and call for a roll. You know, and which is, at the end of the day, that's the only thing a GM needs. It's like, okay, you told me how to resolve literally any action anyone can blurt out of their mouth. I'm done. I don't need the rest of the rules. You know, everything else on there is just gravy.
I've heard a lot of people make that same comment with regards to either AD&D first edition or even basic D&D on mm-hmm. things where, why does the cleric roll this and then the thief rolls, you know, a percentile dice on this, and mm-hmm. like why do we have these different roles? I don't actually mind it. I kind of like the idea of there being some systems where it's not just a d20 and that's all you ever do. I get that it can be more taxing on the GM to remember, but I think for the player, especially if you're playing any character for more than a session, you would know what your mechanic is, and you don't really care what somebody else's character's mechanic is for it. But
and I'll even say, you go back to AD&D second edition or basic or whatever, and playing a character then was a hell of a lot easier than a character now after it gets up to about third level. So
yeah.
I'm not saying it's too hard, but you know,
yeah, the universal mechanic is a game changer. I'm just not, again, I get personal bias on it, but yeah, I can see why that would be something. So is there, you mentioned before the singing the praises of fourth edition. Mm-hmm. Is there something, regardless of how fourth edition is perceived now, if you were to pull out one mythos from fourth edition or one design principle from it, what would you take and say this is something that was done right and we didn't keep it going and we should have?
Okay, yeah, I'll tell you my favorite one. Okay, and this was more behind the scenes. This wasn't something that a GM usually saw, but it was there. You could design nothing for the game unless you knew what it was supposed to do in the game. Okay. So, for example, every class had to have a strategic role and a source of its abilities, right? So you had martial characters and divine characters and primal characters, and you had defenders and strikers and leaders and whatever. You were not allowed to design a class for the game unless you knew what its role was in the team. Okay, which meant you didn't have any arguments. Well, what is the ranger even supposed to be? Or, well, the monk has 17 different abilities and he sucks at all of them. Or what even is a bard? Because you had to start with a solid design statement. Say, okay, the bard is an arcane character who is a leader. He brings out the best in everybody. And then you can design to that, and you have a bard. Maybe it's not, you know, the scald that you imagine of Norse mythology, but it is at least something that has a very solid identity, and everyone can look at that and say, well, that's what the bard is. I'm going to play that. And it was the same on the monster side. You had to decide, is this a monster that plays by itself, or does it need a team around it? And what does it do? You know, how does it fight? Is it just a hit point sponge, or does it do a lot of damage? Or is it sneaky or skulky, or does it take control? But literally everything had to have a design purpose before you were allowed to design it. And that's not something you see. Now they just throw classes. We have the classes in 5e we have because they've been in other editions of D&D. And they still can't get the ranger right because no one can decide what the hell a ranger is supposed to be. Because the answer is, of course, the ranger is so many things at this point that there is no one answer. So just pick a lane and stay in it. And then if some people say, well, I don't like your ranger because it's not like that, you say, well, that's tough because this is what our ranger is.
Yeah, go make your own.
Right. And you can.
Exactly.
But that was it. 4E made everything explain what it was going to do in the game before you were allowed to write it. You know, and that changed everything. And I really think I would like to see designers thinking like, huh, before I design a thing, what's the purpose of this design? I realize that's a crazy thing for a designer to start with. Why am I making this thing and what's it going to do? But 4E is the only edition that outright said, those are the rules. If you're going to sit down and design a thing, know what you're trying to design. And the designs are actually a lot more solid because of it.
The whole design behind 4E gets likened to video games so often. People will say that it was reaction to WoW or it was reaction to whatever, that it was a video game-ation of D&D. I looked at it as them kind of fully embracing the combat side of D&D and saying, let's make a tactical game. Like that's how I always kind of viewed 4E, was that it was it was a definite raising of the combat pillar, a definite raising of the tactical pillar of the game, more so than anything else. But that whole idea of having a built-in safety net in terms of, like, you can't just throw something in for willy-nilly. You have to come up with a plan for it is an interesting viewpoint of how to kind of frame all that. I have to think about more on that, I think, actually.
And you're not wrong. Like, first of all, yes, D&D 4E did dial up the tactical element, but I don't think that it was any more of a tactically focused game than 3.5 was, or 3.0. Okay, that was the, like, honestly, the era of the, you had to have a grid, and you had to have tokens, and you had to mark positions. That was something that it was already creeping into AD&D 2nd edition. You know, and then by the time 3rd edition came in, it fully embraced that. It has a very crunchy combat engine. 4E, if it's guilty of anything, it may be guilty of stripping away the parts that aren't the combat engine a little too much. And I will certainly agree with that. But I don't think the combat engine was any crunchier than the 3rd edition combat engine. You know,
when we talk about designing something, whether it's for 4E or any other game, and you've been very open that, you know, you think games should be hacked on and worked around a bit. I've many times seen people come into like, say, the OSR subreddit or on different Discords, and before they've ever played the game, before they've even, like, sat down and ran it or played it as a player, you'll see people going, hey, can somebody give me some, like, the best house rules for this game? And I always kind of have the same, like, you should play the game, you know, as it's there, as it was designed. Play it as it was designed. And if your table, if you and your players find problems, hack around the problems that you find. Don't try to solve problems before you've ever even encountered them, because you don't know what you might be goofing with the design. Mm-hmm. Do you kind of see that same thing? Or is my advice way off? Like, am I running counter to how you would see this?
No, actually, I have a rule, and I've cited this a couple of times on my own blog. It's the 12 session or 3 month rule. Okay. It is, before you mess with a game, before you even give an opinion on a game, you must play it or run it for 12 sessions or 3 months. Until then, you are not qualified to have an opinion, and you are certainly not qualified to modify the game. You know, and I realize, like, you know, it's not like I can pull people's license. I say, I've revoked your license to hack. You only ran 8 sessions of this game. But really, like, I don't think you can even have an opinion of a game without the table experience. And role-playing games are an emergent gameplay experience. There are so many little moving parts and so many things that just come from the way the systems rub against each other and the way people rub against the systems, that you need some time. Like, if you've never played a role-playing game before, it takes a month before you even, or 4 sessions, before you even know what the hell you're doing. Like, before you even make sense, oh, okay, it's just talk back and forth. I got that now. And then it's another month of kind of settling into things. And then in the 3rd month, you start, yeah, I think I'm really enjoying this, but you know what would be better? You know? So yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. I won't give an opinion on a game I haven't played at least 12 sessions of. And I certainly wouldn't hack it. And honestly, I think if you're going to GM a new system, and I'm really hardcore here when I'm going to say this, if you're going to GM a new system, the first thing you should do is run a published module. Okay, because you don't even know how to write adventures for that game.
Right.
Now, I know, you know, me saying published module, it's like, well, I guess if you don't want players to have any agency, you might as well. Like, that's not the point. The point is, you don't know how this stuff fits together. So maybe look at how it's fit together. And then if you decide, well, this is crap and there's no agency, well, then at least you're qualified to write your own from there, from a position of knowledge instead of ignorance.
Yeah, I think it's at the very least spending a lot of time reading through modules and understanding, like, critically reading them, like, not just reading them for entertainment purpose, but reading through them and saying, oh, this was I see what the goal of this was, or I see, you know, these encounters were here to lead up to this, or what have you. Reading through them in a critical manner before you start going off and designing, because again, just for the sake of understanding how things connect, I think that's perfectly valid.
Yeah.
And you know, in the editions that I play, it's super easy because there is so many options in terms of modules. Whereas, you know, if it was a brand new game system just came out, you might be a little bit limited on which ones you've got. But I mean, if you talk to anybody from you know, back when we were kids, there was that shared experience of people going through certain modules all the time. Mm-hmm. That, you know, people can reminisce. Everybody played their own homebrew, but there was also certain modules that everybody touched at certain points. And I think if people continue to use those as a learning tool or experimental tool, you can kind of continue those same, you know, shared stories that we all went through the same story, but we all had our own little twist on it type idea, right?
Yeah, there's value to that too. I mean, there is a sense of community there in, you know, knowing that you went through the same adventure as somebody else, and then being able to say, that wasn't the real lich.
Yeah, and I honestly, I think that's why Curse of Strahd is the most popular thing with when it comes to 5e, is because so many people have ran it, and it's got that community of people that have all kind of latched to that as a module that they've got that shared experience with. And I think the people comparing and contrasting the notes from that is part of the reason why that is one of the strongest modules from fifth edition.
Well, I think another thing is, and I'm not particularly fond of the fifth edition take on Curse of Strahd. I, you know, just to be clear, I'm actually very critical of it. But I think if you were going to take an old school module and port it to fifth edition, the absolute best choice is Ravenloft. Okay. And it's precisely because, like, Ravenloft has a unique position in the history of D&D as sort of the module that introduced the concept of narrative. Okay. It was the module that said, we can do more than a site-based adventure. We can tell a tragic romance through D&D.
Now, when you say, which Ravenloft are you citing? Are you talking the I series original, or are you talking? Okay. I just wasn't sure which, because that's my preferred version as well. I just didn't know where, because it's come through so many. It's been on every edition that they've
right.
Did fourth edition do a Ravenloft?
I don't think it did, actually. But
yeah, it's been redone several times. So I just didn't know if you were coming from a particular version.
But do you know what I'm saying, though? In the development of the history of modules for D&D, that was sort of, it wasn't necessarily the first one that said, okay, here we can have a solid narrative, but it was the one that caught the zeitgeist of, we can use this as a storytelling device. You know?
Yeah.
I know it was still, like, Ravenloft was still very much a site-based adventure. And it had some innovative mechanics for replayability that were really neat, like the way it introduced the Taroka deck as a way of, you know, like, now you have, like, what, the ROM randomizers for, you know, different games. And that's basically what it was way back when. But it marked an evolution in gaming toward the more story-based, like, let's call it plot-based rather than site-based.
Right.
It was sort of where those seeds got planted. Well, the modern gamer, the folks who are playing 5e and, you know, even editions before it, one of the things they are very interested in is the game as a character-driven tool and as a story-driven tool. Okay. And I know there's a lot of butting heads there between the OSR community that prefers the site-based or the exploration-based type gameplay. And then you come into this modern view of, well, this is really a narrative tool. and a tool for, see, because I realize that by saying it this way, I'm inviting people to come in and say, yes, but if you do site-based adventures, you have emergent narrative. And I am not denying that, but there is a difference between an emergent accidental narrative and a crafted narrative experience.
I am very much of the opinion that it's not even so much site-based, it's world-based. So mm-hmm. I look at OSR gaming or older edition gaming as being the world being the main character and you're discovering the history of said world. Mm-hmm. And the narrative comes from afterwards looking back going, oh, look at the history that we built with it. Whereas more modern games are more about telling the individual story of an individual rather than that of the world. The world is a backdrop that happens to be there to support the individuals. Whereas the older games, the world was really the main focus and the individuals attempted to try to make some sort of an impact on it. And if they did, great. And maybe when they got to higher levels, it transitioned a little bit closer to what we have now. But at the beginning, nobody cared about the individuals. It was more about the world itself. And now it's very much a care about the individuals.
Yeah. And to be fair, the reason why I have no home in any community anymore is because I am firmly entrenched between those two views. there are merits of both. The problem is if you go too far in any one direction, then you're leaving play experiences on the table. And each of those play experiences has a strength that appeals to, there are reasons why humans play games. There are reasons why humans read stories or enjoy stories. And if you go too far in any one direction, you're giving up some of that, some of the most amazing aspects of human engagement.
Yeah, even if you, even on a smaller level, just the name role-playing game, I've had people where you can look at it and go, you've gone all role-playing. There's no game left. Mm-hmm. And also the other way, you've gone all game, and there's very little role-playing in that either. The role-playing game, both words are important. You need to have both in there, and where you mix that balance is kind of going to determine how much enjoyment any one given group gets out of it. But
right, but I kind of forgot the question that we were pontificating.
I don't know if we had one. Okay, I will go back to. I've got three questions left for you. I know we're getting close to our time, so I'm going to go through three questions for you. Okay.
Okay.
So
lightning round.
Yeah,
I'm good at these.
Lightning round. Question number one is going to be, you mentioned that you've already got a book out and that you had other stuff coming up over the rest of this year, assuming everything can go according to plan.
But God's willing.
Yeah, God's willing. What is the plan for the year? What is some of the stuff that you're hoping comes out should everything go kosher and okay. as wanted?
Well, the biggest one that I would like to launch around May, April or May, is a game tool that I call Tension Dice. Okay. It is a timekeeping and random, I'll say random encounter because that makes it clearer, but it's a random complication and timekeeping tool that is designed to bring back the old concept of turns and rounds, time hours, turns and rounds, timekeeping, to bring back the pressure of if you spend too long in a place, then there's going to be rolls and stuff's going to happen. But to combine it with the narrative tool of mapping the ebb and flow of tension, and also combine it with the personal experience that people naturally have with the passage of time. And it's actually a very, very simple mechanic. I've written about it on my blog several times because it's gone through a couple of iterations. And I meant to launch the project last year, but there were some economic concerns. Supply chain issues kind of shot that down. Plastic and manufacturing became very difficult. So.
Right. Okay. So we've got a dice project Any written works?
I am going to, and this is going to be toward the end of the year, and I don't have a specific date on it, but it is time for me to publish a sequel to my book. Whereas Game Angry, it was written to hand to someone who had never played a role-playing game before, and it would tell them how to get a party together and run their first game and then get passably good at it. This one will be, okay, now you know how to run a game. Here's how to manage an ongoing campaign and write your own content for it. And paired with that will be an updated and revised edition of the original Game Angry as kind of a twofer.
Okay.
Those are my big plans for the year.
And you said earlier Kickstarter is your plan. Is that plan for both of them or just?
Yeah, that's the plan for both of them right now is crowdfunding through Kickstarter.
Awesome. And another question I was going to have is to lean into the angry side for a minute. What's your biggest tabletop RPG pet peeve? What's the one thing that when you see it, you're like, oh, the angry GM's coming in on this one now because you did it.
Okay, let's see. It is tied between chaotic neutral gnome bards. Okay, because that is every warning sign right there that you are going to have a problem with that player. Okay, we all know what chaotic neutral means.
Chaotic stupid.
No. Worse. It means my GM won't let me play evil, but I'm going to do it anyway. Okay, gnome means prankster. And bard means flamboyant about it. Okay, the spotlight hog. I am going to be in the spotlight in every scene. So I am going to be a sociopathic prankster who steals every spotlight, right? But those are the three warning signs: chaotic neutral, gnome, and bard. Run. The other thing, backstory that is more than one paragraph.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm right up with you on that pulpit as well. I often say that backstory is completely for the player. I don't even care to know about it. It's for me. I'm like, I've gotten a bunch of backlash on that too, of like, it adds to the world. I'm like, no,
it does not.
You don't know the world until you've played in it.
So right. Well, this is beyond that. It actually interferes with the player's ability to form a relationship with their own character.
Because they've written themselves into a corner more times than not.
Well, and they're never going to play what they wrote. Okay, no, I'm serious. You cannot write a character you have not portrayed because they are not going to be the character that you wrote down. As soon as the dynamics of play and the dynamics of the party get involved, your character is going to change. And then one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to say, well, I'm not playing the character that I wrote my backstory for anymore and have to throw it away anyway. Or you're going to say, well, I have to play the character I wrote and force it. And yeah, either way, you're going to end up miserable.
Yeah, I've reminded people before. I don't know if I've actually done it on the podcast, but I've in other conversations with people also said that, hey, when an author sits down and writes a book, they can create a character's backstory and everything. And it all works because they are in complete control of everything that happens in said book and every other character. But when you're a player, you control yourself and you have no idea of how anything else is going to work. So if you try to create a lengthy backstory and, you know, the personality of a character before you've ever sat down and interacted with anything else, you have no control over that. It'll never work out because...
Well, beyond that, authors have an adage, and that is backstory are the parts of the story too boring to include in the story. No, I'm serious. Yeah. Backstory part, if the backstory is interesting, you start the story there. You make that the story. Okay. No player has ever written a backstory thinking, well, this is going to be the least interesting thing about my character. Okay, every player who sits down to write a backstory says, I'm going to write the bestest backstory ever for the bestest character ever, which means you're already doing it wrong. Okay, the backstory should be the least important things that have ever happened to your character. Okay. Otherwise, you should play that. But you can't risk playing that because it might not turn out the way you wrote it.
Right. All right, so we now know what gets the angry GM angry. Here's my last question for you. It's one I've kind of I throw at a lot of people in different interviews. Is you've been around for a long while in the blog sphere, in the whole community.
What I've outlived the blogosphere. The blogosphere is done and I'm still there.
Yeah. We joked before we hit the record button about, oh, you're still doing a blog in year 2024. How's that going for you? But
Well, now I have zero competition.
Yeah, true. But what is something that people don't know about you that you would like them to have known, or that you think people should know about you? Or what's something that, if you've done an interview like this one, that I should have asked, or somebody else would have asked, that you would have liked to have had the opportunity to talk about a little bit more?
You know what? That's actually really a tough one, because one of the things I pride myself on, especially with my supporters, is integrity and transparency. I hold very little back, and I think that's important as a creator, that especially a crowdfunded, supported creator, is that the creator treats the people who support them as like with the same honesty that you would treat customers. And when I say that, I don't mean like the way Wizards of the Coast treats customers. I mean the way a good business treats customers. So there, I don't have a whole lot of secrets, and I'm not actually really that mysterious. I think the one thing that I like people to ask that they very rarely do is, how much of the angry persona is really me?
Here's your chance. How much of the anchor persona is really you?
Enough to keep me honest. There's a lot more of that in me, for better or for worse, than most people realize. That it's actually not as much of an act as it seems. I am very bombastic. I am over the top. I have actually had a player, she cried after her first session at my table, and then proceeded to have nightmares about me yelling at her.
Wow.
Yep. She is one of my best friends. She's my cousin's wife now, and they are my best friends. But nonetheless, the first time they played D&D, she apparently went home crying. And part of it is just that, like, I do have this sort of bombastic over the, like, I will launch into a rant. It's like a Lewis Black style thing. And I'm not really that serious. Like, it's more for show than anything. But if you don't know me, it's like, is he really mad? But, you know, there is a lot of me when I'm swearing at people on the blog and saying, how can people be this dumb? I actually mean it more than people think. It's like, what the hell is wrong with you people at this point? How can you still be making these mistakes?
So you get the benefit of being able just to say what other people think and then filter out, but you can say it and people can sometimes brush it off. Oh, that's just his persona. But you
that has saved me more times than I care to admit. Oh, well, that's just your persona. Like, yep, I guess it is, asshole. You do keep me and you angry. He called me. But yeah.
I think I know what's going to be opening the podcast now. So where should people go to find, if this is the first time by some chance that they're coming across you, where should they go to find the blog and you know, what's the URLs? Where should people go to look to find you either on the blog or elsewhere?
Actually, the blog is literally the best place to find me because everything else spawns from that. So just go to theangrygm.com. And you will find me there, and then you will find links to, honestly, I really do very little else. I've only recently started getting active on social media again. I took a long hiatus from social media, mainly because it became insufferable. It was too bad for angry. But, you know, so that's it. The blog is where I'm at, and you can find links to everything else there. If you want to buy a copy of my book, though, you might want to wait because there's a new edition coming. Which that's terrible marketing for me to say, but there's my integrity shooting me in the foot. I do have a store. It's at angry.games/shop. But if you just go to angry.games, that's my corporate headquarters. That's the site for Angry Games Incorporated.
And Do you are you a person that frequents cons or anything like that? Is if people wanted to meet up with you at all, is that something you do, or is it?
It's something that I used to do a lot more, but for some reason, the last 2 years, a lot of my con going fell off.
Yeah, I wonder why over the last couple of years.
Right?
What may have happened in the world? The
last couple of years. but I'm exploring the possibility of going to GaryCon this year here in Wisconsin, because I'm a Wisconsinite. But likely this year, there will be very few cons. So my girlfriend and I are now fiance and fiancee.
Fiancee.
And we have hunkered down, and we are trying to hold on to as much money as possible for a wedding in about 18 months, which is another great reason to support me or support my Kickstarters, because you'll be helping me get married. But in all seriousness, probably there will not be travel much for the next year. But after that, I would like to get back to going to conventions. I used to make it a point to go to Gen Con every year. I need to get to Origins. And I also like attending the conventions here in Wisconsin, especially GaryCon and GameholeCon in Madison. They're both wonderful wonderful conventions for different reasons.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming onto the show. Hopefully this was fairly painless and a fun time for you as well. It was for me. And just thank you for coming on. It was a lot of fun to chat with you.
I had a blast. Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, that's going to wrap up this episode of the Red Caps Podcast. I hope you enjoyed, you learned something, and that you were eager to come back for more. www.theredcaps.net has all the links to all the ways to contact me, and I would love to hear from you. Thank you ever so much for listening, and remember, never let your caps dry out. Stay safe, have fun. We'll talk again soon.